We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
How the hell are you, Higher Side Chatters? It's another sunny San Diego day, and I'm still Greg Carlwood, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. People, I know we're all feeling the pinch of the global elite's stranglehold on the major aspects of our daily lives, and I would say things seem more volatile now than they have in decades, from bank runs and the collapse of currencies to the incremental advancement of control by force, guilty until proven innocent, and the crackdown of any resistance to this game plan, peaceful or otherwise. It is tough to see a path to prosperity through the onslaught of darkness and the economic quicksand slowly creeping up the legs of the masses. And here at THC, we've talked about all-encompassing solutions like the Venus Project and the resource-based economy model. But what do we do if we can't change the world? How can we use our knowledge and perspective to give ourselves something a little more beneficial than a stress-induced heart attack and a substance abuse problem? Well, folks, a lot of people these days are talking about the increase in popularity of the digital currency known as Bitcoin, a decentralized currency beyond the grasp of the big banks and the Rothschild dynasty. While there are no guarantees in life, Bitcoin seems to be one of the few ways an average Joe could really become wealthy in this climate of collapse. But nobody makes it big by being late to the party and doing the work to understand this complex system before the mainstream is what could catapult a Subway sandwich artist to the level of the early adopters of the internet boom. This is an important episode, maybe the most important episode of our lives. And with that, I'm here with a man who's already done a lot of that homework and is going to share with us his research and personal experience with Bitcoin. And that man is David Seaman. He's a freelance journalist and has been a contributor and guest on shows and networks like CNN, Fox News, ABC, and two of my personal favorites, Coast to Coast AM and The Joe Rogan Experience. He's also the author of a new ebook, and he's the man behind the David Seaman Hour. David, welcome to THC.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course, man. It's my pleasure. And I have to admit, I know a lot less about your career and background than most of my guests, which is because this interview was arranged when I asked the listeners through Twitter who would be a good guest for the show on Bitcoin. And your name came up about a dozen times, and you hit me up and said you'd do it, and boom, here we are. So I tried to do some research, but couldn't find much about how you really got started and worked your way up to things like Coast to Coast and CNN. So I mean, tell me a bit about your story, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I always love to talk about myself. Sure. So basically, my first job out of college, I went to school in New York, and my first job that I was able to land was as a reporter at a personal finance website. And so I was covering financial topics and some political stuff also. And after I left that job, I actually launched a popular credit card deals comparison site where you can compare, you know, all the different offers from major banks, you know, compare interest rates and the sign-up bonus and all that stuff. And from there, I was just a tech entrepreneur for a while because I was busy growing that. And I really understood that the way that credit card companies were marketing their products of just, you know, sending people these offers in the mail was highly inefficient and just not really up to speed. You know, when you book airfare, you just you go on a website and you book it. You don't wait for the airline to contact you and offer you some special rate. So from there, in, I guess, when was this? I guess around mid to late 2011, I had a really bad run-in with the TSA. I was on a business trip, and they pulled me aside, and some fat, sweaty guy started grabbing my balls. Damn. And it was just kind of a wake-up call for me. I was like, is this really where America has gotten to, where nobody is safe? You know, they can just abuse their authority because this guy is wearing a blue shirt and has a badge on. He can grab my private parts and, you know, take away my laptop. And you start to lose your rights very quickly in a situation like that. And I was like, this is insanity, you know. And so shortly after that, I found out about something called the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is normally passed every year. And this particular year's bill included a section that would allow for the imprisonment without trial of American citizens. And I was like, this is absolute craziness. You know, there's no way this is real. But I did the research, and the ACLU had come out against it. Amnesty International was worried about it. But everybody was like, don't worry, Obama's going to veto this thing. And so I wrote an article about it for one of the sites that I contributed to at the time, a popular business publication. And I wrote the article about it. I did a YouTube video, and I felt like my job was done. I was like, there's no way this is actually going to become law, you know? And then on New Year's Eve, it was signed into law. And that was kind of the second wake-up call for me. So I guess the first one was having my testicles grabbed. The second one was watching as the president signed into law something that allows him to imprison Americans without a trial on New Year's Eve, when you're not supposed to be doing any official business, you know, because everybody's out partying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, something deeply dishonest is going on here. And even though it wasn't my background, I'm certainly a pretty moderate guy. I mean, I'm a guy who created a credit card deals website. I'm not exactly an occupier. And from there, I was like, there are some serious challenges in this country. And I started covering the NDAA thing. And, you know, a lot of more independent-minded shows wanted to have me on to explain it. And from there, I just became interested in covering these civil liberties issues because they're such a big deal, you know, and it's something that for some reason is not really breaking through to the mainstream to the extent that it should. Although recently the whole drone debate, that actually broke through, became totally mainstream, which I thought was really kind of exciting to see that because I had friends calling me saying, oh, Dave, this is the thing you've been talking about for the past year. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, at least now people are paying attention. And so I'm just at this point, I still do my tech entrepreneur stuff, and I have a podcast now where I talk about stuff that interests me. And I just, whenever I come across something that's important, like NDAA or like Bitcoin, I try to do whatever I can to shake the branches and to get people aware of what's going on.
Of course, man. And, you know, you brought up NDAA. One thing I think is really troubling about recent events is that you have the government pushing things like NDAA and domestic drone strikes, and which I constantly see citizen resistance to when it's talked about broadly or hypothetically, but I don't see as much resistance when the government is being ridiculously aggressive and hunting down people like the rogue LAPD cop, the Dorner guy, or these two guys involved with the Boston thing. Situations where these people could be scapegoats or patsies possibly, but we won't ever know in the mainstream because there's just no trials or debates anymore. You know, it seems like people are really against it when it's just on paper, but then when you see the actual villain on television, everyone's like, oh, we'll get that guy. Or at least there's not as much resistance. Do you find that troubling?
I do, but it's only human nature. You know, when something happens, people are frightened by it and they want a rapid resolution. And, you know, people grew up under the assumption that what you see on TV has been vetted and has some, you know, accuracy to it. And unfortunately, we've come to realize that that's not really the case. The people on TV telling us what's going on are, in many cases, pundits with financial ties to defense contractor companies that make money off of this stuff. They make money selling fear. And some people don't really understand, how does that work? How do they make money by scaring people? And the answer is they get defense contracts for various services, for, you know, surveillance software and defense contractors in the form of like pseudo-military type guys. And there are billions of dollars being made from this stuff by creating a demand for something that is not, perhaps not really necessary. And so it's, I think at the end of the day, it's about money and it's about manipulating people. And, you know, the average person is so busy with work with paying their mortgage, with taking care of their kids. They don't go all that deep. They don't think about the implications of chanting USA, USA after some kind of crazy Orwellian manhunt goes down.
Agreed.
Where you haven't seen a shred of evidence. And to be sure, whoever did that bombing, I don't know if I can curse on this show.
Yes, please do.
Whoever is responsible for that bombing is a total piece of shit and deserves the worst that our justice system can serve up. But we have to make sure that we get the right people. And the government has been wrong about so many things over the past 10 or 11 years that just pointing a finger at somebody and saying, this is a really bad guy, I no longer believe that. You know, I want to see proof. That's our whole system, is that we're innocent until proven guilty, not guilty until proven innocent.
Right. It is fucked up the direction they're taking that. But, you know, let's talk bitcoins, man. You know, this being a conspiracy show, the audience is pretty well versed in fractional reserve banking, the mechanisms of interest and inflation, the realization that our currency is based on nothing and we're getting fucked by the Federal Reserve like the Pope's favorite orphan. But having a pretty deep understanding of these things, I think it gives us a leg up on understanding how Bitcoin is different. But tell us, how is it different?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, first of all, I used to think that the Federal Reserve people, the people who ranted against the Federal Reserve, were the craziest of the crazies.
Yeah.
But the more research I did, you know, when you control the money supply and you can control how your citizens buy and sell things and how they are able to store their own wealth from their own hard-earned work, when you have ultimate say over those things, gives you a great degree of control over the population. You can just arbitrarily decide to print more money and inflate your currency and basically wipe out the stored wealth of your citizens and take away their personal power and their personal sovereignty. And so I think with something like Bitcoin, there are things built into the system, certain promises that cannot really be broken because it's right there in the software code. And it's decentralized. So no one company is responsible for Bitcoin. It's a decentralized service across thousands of servers. And it's semi-anonymous in the sense that you can just create a new public address, which is a string of numbers and letters, use that to send money to another public address, and then never use that address again. You can have throwaway accounts. And so there are a couple of promises with Bitcoin. One of them is that there are around 11 million coins in existence right now, and that number is increasing based on a mathematical formula. People, quote-unquote, mine bitcoins by having high-speed computers do certain mathematical processes. And in the same way that it's difficult to mine gold, that it takes up time and money to do so, it's difficult to mine bitcoins. It takes up computing resources and time and money, because it takes up money because you need a fast computer and there are energy costs involved. And so the idea there is to have something that is artificially restricted. So mm-hmm. The great thing about Bitcoin is no Ben Bernanke type can come along and say, we're going to go ahead and pump 100 million new Bitcoins into circulation. That's impossible. It cannot happen. So the absolute most Bitcoins there will ever be on the planet is 21 million. I think in the year 2140 or 2120, it'll be 21 million coins. And that's a pretty great assurance, because you know that you're taking part in a currency or a transactional system, whatever you want to call it. You're taking part in a system that A, is not controlled by any one government or party. B, cannot, even if it wanted to, inflate the currency. And then there are all the technological, I think there are benefits, but that remains to be seen, of just how fast you can send money to any other party and how cheap it is. Like to send... The example that I give people in interviews is to send $10,000 to a family member in another country, let's say a family member in India or something, to send them $10,000 over PayPal would cost the recipient a fee of around $299. It would cost my family member $299. And with Bitcoin, it would cost at current market price for Bitcoin less than a nickel. So I mean, and you're talking about also not needing a bank account and no chance of PayPal freezing the funds or messing it up somewhere along the way. Just that complete assurance that the transaction is going to be made. And there's no such thing as chargeback fraud on Bitcoin. At the same time, I mean, the downside of that is nobody is there to hold your hand. So if somebody installs some malware on your computer, which can happen if you go to the wrong website and install some Java program, it can search your hard drive, look for your private keys, which is what gives anybody access to your coins, and they could just jack your money. And if yeah. that happens, you have no recourse whatsoever. But, I mean, on the flip side of that, that lack of any central authority is what allows the fees to be so extremely low.
It makes sense. I mean, I would be a little worried because I don't know much about internet security, but let's go back to the mining aspect. It's kind of strange to me that you just get a mathematical algorithm, and if my computer can pull a Goodwill Hunting and solve that shit, I get 50 bitcoins. I mean, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense because I don't see how giving a giant calculator a math problem is something that's difficult or going to create value. Isn't that the same as a money printer up until we reach that 21 million cap?
It's really the same, I think, as something like Google. Google has a spider that is always searching the internet for new content. So if you have a website, it'll routinely visit your site and look for new articles and new blog posts and then add that to its index. And in the same way, I think that what the mining does is takes an idea that's been around for thousands of years, which is that something can only be a currency if it is somewhat scarce. Like you'll get gold.
Right.
I mean, gold doesn't, I know a lot of your listeners are going to disagree with this, but gold doesn't have any fundamental value in the sense that it's just a metal. There are many metals on Earth. And yeah, it's great that it's an awesome conductor of electricity and that it doesn't rust. Like those are certainly really cool properties. But at the end of the day, A, gold is not truly scarce because we could lasso an asteroid that has $1 trillion of gold on it, right?
True.
In the universe, gold is not scarce. And so one of the things that makes gold a really good currency is that we know there's only so much of it, and we know that it's difficult to create new gold. You know, it's not easy to start up a gold mine, and to pull it out of the earth costs you a certain amount of money. And so people know that if I you know, stack up gold coins for a while, there's not going to be some situation where, you know, 100 million ounces of gold just materializes and blows away the demand by rapidly increasing supply. So whoever created Bitcoin, I think, was looking at that idea of scarcity and trying to apply it as best as he could to the digital age. And I think the mining thing, although it seems kind of silly, certainly it's hard for me to wrap my head around. I think what we're really talking about is that they created a model where scarcity is built in, but where there isn't total scarcity. Like there are new mm-hmm. coins being created, which I think is a good thing because you don't want to be in a situation where all of the early adopters just hoard their coins and then there's no actual, no flow of currency. That wouldn't be a very good system.
Right. Well, up until I really started looking at this in preparation for the interview, I had just thought that you would exchange dollars for bitcoins, which of course I know you can do too. And I would think, man, I wish I did that when it was 5 cents, you know, a bitcoin was 5 cents, but of course now it's gone up to $100 and more and beyond. But the mining aspect seems like, you know, you could just get, it doesn't matter what the exchange rate is because you can just kind of create it. It's a little bit strange, but I mean, are you mining for them? Like, can you explain the process? What would someone do if they wanted to set up their computer? Because it seems no risk, really. I mean, what's the risk in downloading the program and having your computer mine bitcoins?
Well, I don't think the average computer is really good enough to get you many coins. So like there are companies that sell what they call mining rigs. And a mining rig is like a really high speed server designed to handle this kind of mathematical process. And so there are companies selling this stuff, and it seems to me a little bit scammy because it's kind of like the people trying to sell you mining equipment during the California gold rush, right? Like some of the gold miners will make a lot of money, but these companies selling you the equipment only want to make money off the miners. They don't really care if you make money or not. And it's also true that if you were an early adopter of Bitcoin, like I had one of the big time Bitcoin investors on my podcast last year when it was at like $20 or $30 a coin. And he was talking about it and I was like, this is a really good idea, but I never put any money into it. And, you know, you can definitely you can slap yourself across the face for not having realized that something is a good idea earlier. But I think we're still in such the early stages because I actually, after I wrote an article about Bitcoin, I went to the mall and just asked different people in the mall, people in the food court. I asked a girl working at the Tivana store. I asked some people stacking shirts if they had heard of Bitcoin, and no one had. So clearly we're not at a point where it's saturated. If you ask everybody, have you heard of Google or have you heard of PayPal? They're like, of course, you know. But Bitcoin is something that is still on the edges. And there are a couple of things that excite me about it aside from what we just talked about. And what excites me is that the right kinds of people seem to be adopting it. Really tech-savvy people, the same kinds of people who were using Google back when everybody else was using AltaVista and Excite, are now starting to use Bitcoins to buy and sell things. And so if you're interested in Bitcoin, I would not even look at it as an investment, because in the short term, you could lose a lot of money. Like it fluctuates wildly. But if you really believe in it, as I'm starting to believe in it, then you don't even care that much about the daily price, because it's like to buy 1% of Visa and MasterCard back in the 60s, what would that be worth? Would that be worth $1,000? Would that be worth $10,000? You know, it's worth a lot of money if you end up being one of the early adopters of something that becomes a global transaction network. And the flip side of that is it could be worthless in a couple of years. Something better could come along, in which case nobody will be using Bitcoin.
I mean, that's true. I sometimes fantasize about traveling back in time and making the right investments, you know, or being one of the first people to start podcasting or learning web development or to create Reddit or Facebook before it was there, you know? And Bitcoin to me could be one of those things, you know, if you get in early enough. But with all the attention it's getting and the huge increase in value, I am worried that someone getting into it now would be a little late to that party. But explain the steps on how someone would get going. You know, let's say I got $100. I want to get in on Bitcoins. I mean, I hear about this dark web and that it's like almost like a hacker's internet beneath the internet, you know, like the back alleys of the internet. How do you get into the system? Like if I had some cash I wanted to exchange?
Yeah, Bitcoin first took off with some sort of shady uses. It was used on a couple of websites or services where people buy and sell illegal things. And so Bitcoin, to that market, it made sense for them to use Bitcoin instead of using credit cards or PayPal. And it's kind of an unusual market to adopt a currency. But at the end of the day, a currency, you know, the US dollar is used by all kinds of shady people. Currency doesn't discriminate between ethical or unethical transactions. And I don't know where I was going with this, but I think that what was your question again about how you get into it, right?
Yeah, if I had some cash and I wanted to get into it.
Yeah, I think that the fact that Bitcoin has some seedy uses right now doesn't really mean anything. In fact, I believe that one of the first big markets to begin taking it will probably be porn sites. Porn sites and webcam companies and things like that. Actually, one of the big dating sites, OkCupid, just recently announced they're going to take Bitcoin as a form of payment. And if you have a little bit of money and you want to convert it into Bitcoin, the best way to do that is to use a service that will do that for you. There are services like the biggest exchange right now is Mt. Gox, which is mtgox.com. And they've had some technical problems in the past, but they're currently the biggest out there. And the next few months, I have reason to believe that it seems pretty likely that new exchanges will be coming online to provide the service that Mt. Gox does. But basically, it's the same as, you know, similar to an E-Trade account. You sign up for the account and you can put money in using your bank account or some other payment method. And then you can buy Bitcoin at the existing market rate and do what you want with it.
That's cool. I have a T-shirt brand called Conspiratees, which with a bunch of anti-establishment designs. And also, you know, I noticed you started taking donations on your web. I take donations too, but you started taking them in Bitcoin. How could someone set that up on their website?
Okay. Yeah, it's actually really easy. So once you own some Bitcoin, the hardest part of the whole Bitcoin ecosystem right now, and what's really, I think, holding it back from greater adoption, is the fact that the exchanges out there right now are not too numerous and they're not very good, you know. Once it gets easier for people to convert their dollars or their euros into Bitcoin, to do that easily and quickly, then we'll see many more people use it, I think. But once you have your money in the form of Bitcoin, then you sign up for a wallet or you download. I think the safest way actually is to download a wallet client. The place to do that, you go to bitcoin.org, which is the official Bitcoin site. Bitcoin.org shows you a couple of the clients that are trusted, that you know are not going to just, you know, jack your coins, things that have been looked at. And there are a few popular clients. One of them is Multibit. One of them is Electrum. And you transfer from your exchange account, you transfer the coins into your wallet. And your wallet will provide you with a receiving address, which is just a string of letters and numbers. And you transfer the money into your wallet. And then you, from that wallet, you can send money to any other address, any other Bitcoin address. And your wallet also has its own address. So you just copy and paste that address, that string of numbers and letters, put it on your website and say, you know, tip me via Bitcoin. And then anybody who comes across that page and has a Bitcoin wallet and they want to tip you, they would just copy and paste that string and put it into their wallet client and send you the desired amount of money. And then it'll be in your account, you know, within a matter of, you'll be notified pretty much immediately. And then the transaction takes an hour or two to verify and settle.
Okay. So to get started, as a user, someone would get linked up with one of these exchanges. But hasn't there been in the past week or so a couple of cases of these exchanges getting like denial of service attacked and hacked into, and haven't some of them gone under?
Yeah, not only have there been denial of service attacks, one of the ones that I thought was actually the best just closed up shop. I think their bank account was seized or frozen or something.
Yeah, that's scary.
And, it is scary, which is why when you buy them at the exchange, some people are only doing this to speculate, and they keep their money in the exchange account. They keep their Bitcoin there. And their hope is that they're going to sell it back out into U.S. dollars when the price goes up. I think that's a really dangerous thing to do because, first of all, you shouldn't be speculating with something like this because you'll lose money. And second of all, the exchange could just go under, and it could also be attacked, and people can steal your Bitcoins that way. If you think about it, if you're some hacker and you are really good at what you do and you have no moral scruples, you would probably want to target an exchange because there are hundreds of millions of dollars of Bitcoin just sitting there in people's accounts. So it's a really bad idea to keep your Bitcoin on an exchange account for very long. Once your transaction is cleared and you own the Bitcoin, send them off to your wallet public address. And from there, you actually have the coins on your computer and they can't be taken from you unless the only way they can be taken from you at that point is if your computer is compromised. Other than that, they cannot be taken. And there are even people who go pretty extreme and create what are called cold wallets. And a cold wallet is when you transfer the private key to like a USB flash drive and then pull that flash drive out and make sure that it's never connected to the internet again, right? So then you have no exposure and it's impossible for anybody to steal your private key unless they were to come into your house and like steal the flash drive from you. And I think the Winklevoss twins, who were, you know, in that movie The Social Network, mm-hmm. and they claimed they were like the creators of Facebook. They own, I believe, 1% of all Bitcoin out there. And apparently the way that they are storing their Bitcoin is by doing this cold wallet thing of putting it on a flash drive, because I guess they own so much of it, they don't want it to be stolen, which makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think we are in a time of economic uncertainty. I mean, you know, you can go over to Cyprus and tell the people not to use Bitcoin because it's not secure, and they're going to laugh at you. You know, our banks are secure to a point. You know, they haven't always been. You know, it is what it is. But you had mentioned gold, and I know that gold, investing in gold and conspiracy kind of goes hand in hand, you know, thanks to Alex Jones. But I think this audience is a little bit beyond that. I mean, I myself kind of think gold is pretty saturated, at least, you know, to someone like me who's just making an average wage. You know, I'm not going to be able to afford much gold. And when the shit goes down, who's going to exchange gold for food? You know, food is where real value is. If there was really any kind of collapse, no one's going to want this stupid yellow rock. They can't do anything with it. It doesn't help you survive. At least that's my view. If things were to get really bad,
you can always go in that direction of things getting really bad. Like I've had people say to me, what if there's a global EMP wave? Wouldn't that wipe out your Bitcoin? And I'm like, if that happened, losing your Bitcoin wallet would be the least of your worries.
Right, you know? Right.
And so you can definitely go down that path of like a scenario where gold becomes worthless. But I think under most circumstances, gold remains a good option for people because even if the US dollar collapses, even if the euro goes away, whatever currency emerges, maybe it's the Chinese yuan, maybe it's something totally different, you'll still be able to exchange your gold for a certain amount of that currency. Gold's been around for thousands of years. I think our species, we're primates. I think we like shiny things. And
it might be that simple.
It's heavy. It doesn't rust. It's really ductile. It's the most ductile metal on Earth. So it has these cool properties, and it happens to be rare enough that people value it.
Well, let's say, a lot of people out there are living paycheck to paycheck. If you wanted to make a serious investment, I mean, you wouldn't call it an investment. It'd be a gamble with Bitcoin. But I think that there's something okay about that. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you don't want to speculate. You don't want to lose money. You can't afford to lose. I'm like, but a lot of people are fucked either way. And if they don't take a serious gamble, they're never going to reach that level. So, I mean, and that's up to the individual. I'm not going to tell anybody what to do. But if I wanted to exchange my paychecks on a weekly basis for Bitcoin, is it possible to live on it? I guess with the exception of rent, because I don't think my landlord's going to take Bitcoins as payment. But can you buy groceries? Are there websites that do that?
Yeah, I mean, if you believe that Bitcoin is going to be as big as I think it's going to be, and you treat it as a gamble, because you don't want to be one of those idiots on Reddit who claims they, sold their house and bought Bitcoin at $250 a coin, and now they're getting divorced. You don't want to be that guy, but as long as you treat it as a gamble and something that you acknowledge is risky, and you keep enough money in U.S. dollars to, continue to pay your rent and pay your health insurance or whatever the hell you have, then I think you're right in the sense that you need to get in there and take some risks if you're ever going to get ahead, or you're just not. And I think Bitcoin, in terms of ideas, it's one of the best ideas I've ever seen. And there's a psychological thing that people do, and I don't know if it even has a name, but it's something I talk about a fair amount. And it's this idea that wherever we are in history is like the biggest things will ever be, right? So like in 2000, and like maybe 2003 or something, I remember I was exchanging emails with Ev Williams, who's one of the founders of Twitter, and he created Blogger and all this stuff. And back then he was just like a dude, so I'd ask him questions about how to change something on my blog. And even back then he was well known, but you didn't really realize that you were emailing a guy who was going to be a billionaire or whatever amount of money he has now, right?
Yeah.
So at the time, you assume that everything is as big as it's going to be. Like, people knew that Google was a big deal back in 2002, that maybe they didn't realize that it was like a $300 billion market cap company, but people knew it was a big deal. And there's this weird kind of this thing that happens in our minds where when we see something that's successful, we go, oh, it's already done. It's saturated.
Yeah.
Like, I was talking to a family member and they were like, oh, Bitcoin's already over. It's already in the news. It's too late to get in. I'm like, I don't think that's really the case. I think something like this, a transaction network, the fact that people are starting to talk about it is actually a very good sign, because if nobody was talking about it and nobody was using it, then there's a very small chance of it becoming adopted. But if you're willing to take the gamble, if you're willing to put some money on the roulette table, if Bitcoin becomes a global alternative to Visa and MasterCard and PayPal, which I think is definitely possible at this point, and if it becomes a global alternative to investing in inflation hedges like gold and silver, and also if it becomes something that the tech generation gets really excited about, the only thing separating Bitcoin from mass adoption at this point, I think, is a couple of good mobile apps that do a good job of doing all the technical stuff for people, right? So instead of this long string of numbers, it'll just have that tied to your email address or tied to your name. And once it becomes user-friendly and fun to use, I think it's very possible that 5 years from now, you could walk into a hip restaurant or a hip bar and it would say, American Express and Bitcoin accepted. And if that's the case, if that's, the little alternative universe that we end up traveling down, if you were to buy Bitcoin now, regardless of what the daily fluctuation is, regardless of if you buy it at $100 or $180, you would be sitting on an astronomical amount of money 5 years from now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like share buttons on a website, because, I don't use a lot of the main sites people use, like Pinterest, obviously, is one of them. There's the one that Facebook has for for photos, whatever that is. Instagram. Like, I don't use a lot of those websites, but when you set up, you know, like a WordPress website, you'll have a share box, and you want to have one for everything, because even if one person were to put your blog on StumbleUpon, that's exposure. So obviously, you know, you just want to accept it. And I feel it's the same way with the currency. Like, if you've got customers, and even if only 1% wants to pay in Bitcoins, that's 1% you're not going to have if you don't adopt to it. So I think a lot of places would do that. But from the perspective of someone who lives paycheck to paycheck, I just think if the Bitcoin were to go under, what difference does it make? Because if I were to convert all my checks to Bitcoin and then just try to make the transactions I need, like for groceries, if there are websites that take that, if it goes under and my wallet's wiped out to zero, well, I just wait 4 or 5 days till Friday comes and I got another paycheck, and that one I just won't convert. Like, you know, if you're living like that, it doesn't seem like that bad of a gamble.
The other thing is you're investing. I don't mean to say investing. You're gambling in something that you actually believe in. If you go to the local casino and you just lose your whole paycheck at the sports table or playing blackjack, you feel like an asshole afterwards, right? But
yes,
if you lost your money and you were doing that to do your part to prop up a global transaction network that would destroy the status quo and give people more control over their own finances, that's something to be proud of, even if you lose your ass on it. And, you know, that's what I tell people. People ask me, how are you getting into Bitcoin? Are you investing in it? I'm like, when I can, I'm helping it out, because this is something I believe in. And if enough people put in a small amount of money, Bitcoin will take off. I mean, it already had, earlier this month, it had like a $2 billion market cap. So people are starting to put money into it. And if it takes off, there's no reason it can't be $100 billion or $200 billion market cap currency.
Right. Of everything I could possibly see, it has the greatest potential for growth because it is the newest. You know, like I said, I think gold is kind of saturated, but Bitcoin's, there's volatility there. It could go to nothing, but I mean, I think the sky could be the limit. And but one interesting aspect of it is I tried to look up who created it, and it doesn't seem like anyone really knows. It might have been some anonymous Asian hacker or something.
Yeah, I think that was actually really smart on his part, or I mean, his or her part. Whoever created this was very intelligent about not only the design, but about making Bitcoin something that is beyond the individual. So if this were a situation where the guy who created it was always on the cover of magazines and was being interviewed on CNN and stuff, then Bitcoin would be open to ad hominem attacks. You know, they would look into the guy's background, they would just fuck him over with some sex scandal or whatever it is.
Right.
And then the whole network loses credibility. Like, oh, this guy's just trying to make money for himself. Look at how many Bitcoin he personally has, right? They can't do any of that stuff because nobody knows who created it. All they know that the source code is good because so many people have looked at it and know that it's the real deal. But they don't know who's behind it, which makes it something that is just, it's almost like it was just created, like, what is the phrase? Like deus ex machina, like whatever that means, like just like from the gods, you know, like it just exists one day. And it kind of came around at exactly the right time. It was like something that the world needed, and it was just created. In the same way that email, like if I were to ask you who invented email, you probably could not tell me. And yet it's a technology that was developed and then very quickly took off worldwide because it was just so obviously better than what had existed before.
Good point. You mentioned people looking at the code, and something I hear a lot in interviews when people are defending Bitcoin is they say, well, the code can't be changed. The code can't be manipulated. And it seems a little bit like wishful thinking. I mean, I'd hoped that to be the case, that it's ironclad, but is it really?
Yeah, I think everything with Bitcoin, you have to really treat it as kind of a dream. You know, like I like that you called it a gamble because it really is like you're putting some money into something that's a dream of a better world. And so could this system be compromised? The thing that gives it a lot of strength, I think, is how decentralized it is. So when every single transaction that happens on the network goes into something called the blockchain, which is a public log of all transactions. Anybody can look at it. You can actually watch it in real time. If you go to blockchain.info, you can see the new transactions coming in and the amounts and where the money's coming from, you know, public receiving address and sending address. And that's phenomenal if you think about it. So it gives a layer of transparency. And it also, these transactions need to be verified by multiple servers before they actually are settled. And that prevents any bad actor from pushing out bogus transactions. You know, you can definitely do stuff like you can steal somebody else's Bitcoins if you plant malware on their computer, or if somebody is not careful about storing their private key and you come across it, you can take their coins that way. But this is not something that can really be, it doesn't seem like it's something that can be technically broken. And I think if it was possible, it would have already happened by now, because a lot of people are trying to make money off of Bitcoin in dishonest ways. And some of the things that scare people about Bitcoin, like the fact that everybody's trying to jack your coins, those are the things that actually kind of excite me, because that's a sign that something is becoming a real currency. If you were to leave...
Demand, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you were to leave a silver coin or a gold coin on a park bench, that thing would be gone in a matter of minutes. You were to leave like a broken bottle, it'll stay there the whole day. And this shows that there is some serious demand for this, and that people from a psychological viewpoint are treating it as money. And at the end of the day, we all have to acknowledge that money is bullshit. You know, it's a social right. contract, and 1,000 years from now, we might not even have money. But we exist in a world where we do, and where it's very important. And so it's cool to see people making that psychological shift into like, oh, even though this is digital and it's not backed by anything, we're going to treat it as money, because that's all the US dollar is. It's not backed by anything. It's right. digital. Like, people assume that there's a dollar out there for every single dollar that's printed. It's not all printed. You know, it's a lot of it's just zeros on a computer screen. And even if it were, what would that mean? So you have a bunch of sheets of paper. How does that make it more legit than anything else?
Of course. I actually was just talking to a buddy of mine, and I was saying, you know, if aliens came down here and they were like, hey, you know, you guys seem cool. You guys are building planes. You guys are doing all kinds of stuff. How do you operate down here? And we explained to them that, well, nobody does anything until this green paper is exchanged. You know, if we didn't exchange this green paper, no one would do shit. And it just seems so silly, because then they'd be like, okay, well, who makes that green paper? I'm like, oh, that guy over there. It's like, okay, well, why do you just let him do that? It is goofy the way we do things. But, you know, I don't want to be too negative on Bitcoin, because I do think it's awesome. But every hacker or internet security person I've ever talked to or heard speak online, they say everything can be compromised. You know, anything, any security you can build can be broken. At least that's what people tend to think on the internet. And so that is worrisome, but all I can do is hope that it is something you can really invest in. I mean, the only idea I had for investing, if I was going to try to get rich, the only thing I could think of was to try to invest in marijuana dispensaries that go public, or if the country starts legalizing weed and it's traded like a commodity, to get in on the ground floor of that, because I think that has huge potential as well. But have you done any digging into other alternative digital currencies? Like, does Bitcoin have any real competition?
There's one called Litecoin that is starting to take off. And so Litecoin is very similar in a lot of ways. It costs less. It's, you know, $2 or $3 a coin instead of whatever Bitcoin is going for now. So that's another possibility if you're somebody who wants to speculate. And like you said, you're paycheck to paycheck and want to put something aside. Litecoin might be a good one to put a little bit of money into, just because if that one takes off, you've gotten in so unbelievably early that you're going to make money off of it. But I think with digital currency, there's going to be a really huge first mover advantage where, you know, everybody's, if it starts to take off, everybody's going to accept Bitcoin. They're not going to accept the 100 copycats, you know?
That's a good point.
And I just want to kind of cap this off by saying I could be wrong about all of this.
Of course.
We know, so you have, if you treat it as you would a hobby, like if you're just a hobbyist about digital currency, then you can't really go wrong. Like, for years, I was just interested in things like blogging. And so it's not like I lost my ass on any blog companies that didn't pull through, because I was only doing it as somebody who was fascinated by what a blog was about. You know, I wasn't trying to make money off of it, and or not exclusively trying to. And the same thing with podcasts. Like, you mentioned earlier that I think you said something like podcasts are already, you know.
Yeah, wouldn't it be awesome to be the first person who started podcasting? You know, look at the audience you'd probably have amassed by now.
Well, let me flip your view on this a little bit. It would have definitely been great to be one of the absolute first podcasters, like to be Adam Curry or Joe Rogan, you know. But after I was on Rogan's show, that's when I realized that podcasting was a huge deal because I got so many reactions to it. And I was like, oh, I should create a podcast. You know, this would be a format where I could just speak my mind, tell people what's going on, and not have to worry about getting an editor's approval, you know, or sure. a producer telling me it can only be 5 minutes long and then we have to go to something else. So it opens you up to just put content out there. And podcasting, I would argue, is still in the very early stages. A lot of people don't listen to any podcasts. You compare that to the example I like to use of Google. Everybody searches on Google. Most people have never listened to a podcast. Something I think only like 20 or 30% of the internet uses internet radio or podcasting. And it's in the very early stages. And we're not competing with other podcasters. We're really competing with television. And television is dying. It's on a death spiral. It's one of those things where you look at the growth rate or you look at the decay rate and you can tell what's going to happen. Like, I can't tell you the exact day when nobody will turn into CNN, when nobody will tune into CNN. I can't tell you that day, but I know that day is coming. You know, it's coming a lot faster than people think. And these traditional networks are losing all their power, and all the power and all the influence is heading into podcasts, and it's heading into YouTube channel creators. I mean, YouTube has 850 million users a month now. That's bigger than any television network. So I guess my point though is, like, if you continue to put out an exciting podcast for people, a couple of years from now, you could easily have hundreds of thousands or millions of listeners, because this is not a saturated market. This is something that most people don't even know about. And the people who listen to podcasts are kind of like connoisseurs, you know, like it's a really tight knit community, but it's not mainstream yet.
True. We have a couple minutes left, and something I wanted to talk to you about. You know, you do talk about citizen journalism a lot. I know you're big on in the internet, and you are a journalist yourself. And we just had, obviously, a terrible tragedy in the Boston bombing. But how have you seen citizen journalism affect the way these things are digested? Because it seems like radically different. Like, a lot of people are getting their news from other sources, like Reddit, as opposed to CNN?
Yeah, good question. I think that the establishment, the mainstream, whatever you want to call it, is losing power because of the internet. Like, before the internet existed, there would be some terrible event that would happen, and on the evening news, they would tell you what you're supposed to think about it and what you're supposed to do to fix it. You know, like, if you support this legislation, it'll keep it from happening again. You know, you don't go, oh, the TV anchors are lying to me. You just go, okay, I'm going to call my senator and make sure they support CISPA, you know, or whatever the thing is. And now we see the alternative views. Now we see somebody on YouTube go, no, that's wrong. CISPA will take away your privacy. It has absolutely nothing to do with preventing terrorism. You know, A, B, and C, look at this. Look at what the ACLU has to say. Look at what Aaron Swartz said about it before he committed suicide. Look at all this shit, right? And it's taking away that authority. That single view no longer exists. Like, it used to be just tuned into the evening news. I can't think of anybody in my age group who watches the evening news. You know, like, I might watch CBS Evening News like once every couple months if I'm in a hotel. And so you're getting like a kind of crowdsourced view of the world, where when an event happens, like something like the Boston attack, I immediately turn to Twitter. And you see real photos from people who happen to be there, photos and videos, just because right. everybody has a cell phone. And you're getting no edit, you know, like, you're not having some CNN producer go, oh, let's air with this video and nothing else, because this is the most impactful. You're getting a much, it's almost as if you're there on the ground. Whenever something happens, whether it's on Capitol Hill and it's, you know, a bill being discussed, or it's a natural disaster, or it's a terrorist attack, whatever it is, now you're getting the views from people who are actually right there. And that's a really exciting thing that you can't stop at this point. Nobody can stop that.
Agreed. And I mean, obviously, a lot of people right off the bat with that were claiming false flag and all that stuff. And being the guy that I am, I mean, Boston bombing, false flag was one of the first things I Googled, because I want to see that side of it. Although I would never claim to know that with any certainty so early or even now. But I mean, now that the dust is settled, no pun intended, have you seen any inconsistencies that have made you skeptical of the official story? Or do you think this is a pretty simple terrorist bombing?
I don't think it's a simple thing. I think that For one thing, the suspect they have in custody now does not seem to be a very bright guy. You know, he seems to be just kind of I call him a dweeb on my show. You know, this is based on his Twitter timeline and some of the public information that has come out about him. He's 19 years old. He doesn't seem like somebody who has the technical skill. And granted, I'm not a terrorism expert, but he doesn't seem like somebody who has the technical skill to build four homemade explosive devices, carefully place them at set points, you know, along the way, and be able to do all this stuff without blowing himself up, you know. It to me seems very unusual. And one of the arguments, which I think makes a lot of sense, is that his older brother might have been the mastermind and he just was sort of sucked into it. I guess that's a possibility. But aside from the motivation behind something like that, I think if you were to look at the causes of domestic terrorism, I believe every single one in the U.S. since 9/11 has been caused by radical Islam. And, you know, there's a thing among liberals to be very sensitive and immediately discount linking religion to terrorism. But when you see a correlation like that, you have to wonder what's going on there, right? Like, at a certain point, it's beyond being politically correct or incorrect. And so we need to figure out why radicalism is making people harm other people in the name of their religion. And that's, I guess that's the first point I'd make. And the second one is, it's not so much what happens, it's how the media and how the government reacts to it. So even 9/11, which is a terrible tragedy and thousands of Americans' lives were lost, that would have been handled differently in a country like Norway. You know, instead of creating laws to take away people's rights and allowing for sneak and peek, warrantless searches of your home and all this creepy Patriot Act shit, instead of all that stuff happening and instead of every creepy defense contractor out there crawling out from under the log and clawing for their part of the defense budget, you know, to make billions of dollars off of 9/11, which is what happened. People made billions of dollars by selling security systems and services to the government after that attack. Instead of all that stuff happening, they might have had an approach like, you know, this is a terrible, terrible tragedy, and we're going to get the people responsible for it, and then we're going to move on with our lives. We're not going to spend a decade self-flagellating over 9/11. And you had, you know, Giuliani, even 8 years after 9/11, was still going on TV and just talking about that and nothing else, pretty much, trying to, you know, just that'd be the first sentence out of his mouth is, well, 9/11 happened. And it was just a really strange response to a terrible attack, you know?
I completely agree. Yeah, that's definitely been milked. I mean, you know, Dick Cheney's milked that whole thing more than anyone, probably. He's still probably, as a huge investor in Halliburton, he's been the one to profit. But, you know, the things with the Boston bombing, I mean, I did see some things that were kind of skeptical. I mean, I don't know if, are you familiar with Trevor Aronson?
No, I'm not familiar. Who is he?
He's a journalist. He wrote a book called Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. And this was a guy that I had on the show a while back, and he went through case after case of the FBI kind of going after Middle Eastern people who live in this country and kind of trying to coax them into situations almost like, it was definitely entrapment. But, you know, they're going to people and actually offering them money to take a shipment somewhere. And people are just like poor and they don't know what's going on. And then the FBI swoops in and busts them for something they created. And an interesting thing I saw was the mother was on TV and she was giving an interview and she was talking about the FBI had been harassing her sons for years and they had been communicating for years. And so I guess one of the big alternative stories is that maybe they somehow got sucked into this situation and maybe they thought they had bombs that weren't going to go off, or they were involved in a training drill and then all of a sudden they did go off. Or maybe, you know, there's also some stuff with these guys who had these hats with the skull logo, the Kraft logo, I believe, is like a military contractor. Like, that was kind of suspicious that they were there. But it kind of fit in line with Trevor Aronson's book of the FBI kind of creating these situations and creating patsies and then, you know, busting their own people, busting their own setups.
Well, I haven't heard all that much about that, but definitely sounds intriguing. And that's that right there are a couple of views that you would not have heard if we didn't have the internet. You know, like they certainly would not air that alternative view
exactly
on the evening news back in the, you know, 80s or 90s. And I saw a photo of the military contractors with the skull hats on, and I didn't know where that came from, but it was certainly weird that that wasn't talked about at all on CNN or Fox or MSNBC, as if that's not relevant that a bunch of dudes in, you know, khakis and military boots are wearing backpacks right in that area. Sure. Has that been confirmed that those photos were taken at that time?
It's tough to say, man, you know, because I'm skeptical of everything. There are liars on both sides. So I really love to digest the conspiracy side, but what's true, I could never say. So to me, it would be impossible to really get that information. I mean, you're a journalist who does research. You know, you might have a better idea of how you would go about proving that. But to me, I'm just like, yeah, I mean, you just have to take somebody's word for it or not. It seems like those pictures were taken at that time.
Well, I don't know. Like the Boston bombing, the other side of it is that from some of the stuff I've seen, these were not very sophisticated weapons, and they're made from common parts. And you could have had a guy who was deeply disturbed and unhappy with his move to America, and, you know, sucked his little brother into it, and was fueled by you know, radical religious ideology. I think he had recently converted to Islam. So you have those combination of factors. You know, we live in a country where if you're a psycho and you have access to certain materials, you can harm people. You know, we don't have like Minority Report pre-crime bureaus. I think we're getting to that point, but we don't have that.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And so, you know, if you're a person in America and you're an asshole, you can harm other people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It's an unfortunate situation. The fact that he did just convert to Islam apparently is definitely eyebrow raising, considering the narrative we're given about Islam in general ever since 9/11. But it's so tough to know. But those hats really make me skeptical. The FBI's the mother talking about the FBI involved with her kids for years is makes me pretty skeptical. There's also a video, and this is one, again, you can't confirm if it's real or not, but the older brother, the official story is that he died, I guess, getting hit by a car by the younger brother fleeing the scene or in the middle of the shootout, and in all the chaos, he died. But there is a video you can find on YouTube of the older brother completely naked in handcuffs, being escorted around the streets, like, you know, being put in the back of a cop car. And again, you know, I've seen the guy. He's a pretty built guy. It looks like him, but is it him? I don't know. But that's a very eyebrow raising video. It's kind of freaky.
Well, I think what's also freaky is I haven't seen that video. I'll have to check that out. is how quickly the media and certain members of the government, they seem to be excited by labeling something as terrorism, which I think is fucking disgusting. You know, like you saw CNN tweet out, like, we're now able to call, or like our editorial decision has come down that we're now calling this an act of terrorism.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? Like, this isn't, you're not like mediating some debate, some political debate, you know, like this shouldn't be something that you're excited about doing. And then after that, there was this huge headline, like terrorism in Boston. And you have politicians saying, this is exactly why we need to get CISPA passed and take away your internet privacy so that this doesn't happen again. So you just have all these dishonest organizations trying to profit from something that nobody should profit from. You know, you should put the people responsible for this in a cage, and that should be the end of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Agreed. But that using that terrorism label is the justification. That's what switches it off in our minds that people should have rights and rights to a trial. I actually thought that was suspicious. Whatever you think about 9/11, I thought that was suspicious about bin Laden, because that was really the first time that there was this international terrorist and there was a hit out on him, and he wasn't going to face any trial or anything like that. When, in my view, even if you think 9/11 was as cut and dry as they say it was, when I look at it, the people who are responsible for 9/11 died in the hijacking. You know, they're the ones who are responsible. They overcame the cockpit and the pilot and flew a plane into a building. That's who they died, you know? So the whole idea of going on this international manhunt, I thought was a little weird anyway, but you know, that was the first time we saw a guy who was not going to get a trial regardless. And ever since, now that label of terrorist is being brought domestically against people like the Dorner guy and these two kids. You know, it's now just something that puts a mental switch off in the American mind that says, okay, we can suspend habeas corpus and no trials. We just need to get this asshole.
Yeah, it is really scary. Like the same with Guantanamo Bay, people say, well, they're the worst of the worst. You shouldn't even care about them. And I'm like, okay, but who the fuck are they? Like, let's get some, like, what did they actually do? Let's get some information. Is this some kind of situation out of a comic book movie? Is Magneto down there and needs to be kept in a, you know, anti-magnetic cage?
Like, right.
Why are these people beyond the rule of law? Are they that scary? Like, our justice system has dealt with some pretty creepy people between serial killers and people like Manson. You know, like, we've dealt with a lot of shit. And for some reason, these people, if it's unpatriotic to ask why they're exempt from the basic rights that our country is supposed to afford to everybody. And maybe that's part of the reason why it's occurring on a base in another country. Like, that's the shadiest agreement ever.
Yeah.
In a country that we have an embargo against, we're like leasing land to put prisoners there and torture them. So we have some kind of distance between that and us. You know, like, oh, it's just Guantanamo Bay. It's a creepy situation. I think history is not going to look back on this time period in a good way. You know, it's gonna be like, why didn't people speak up? You know, why didn't people even maintain a minimum of curiosity as to what the fuck is going on down there?
Absolutely agree, man. That's why we do the shows we do. But you know, it looks like we're getting to the top of the hour. It's been a great conversation. I feel like I learned a lot about Bitcoin, and if I do start throwing my money into it and it really pops off and I make a couple million, that would probably make you the most influential person in my life. And that's saying something. So, you know, thanks for dropping knowledge on us. If there's ever a way you'd like to collaborate in the future, you know where to find me. Maybe you can come back and give us a Bitcoin progress report sometime in the future. But it was a pleasure to make your acquaintance, Pimp. And if there's anything you want to leave the people with, maybe your website or maybe your ebook.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation. I definitely want to do it again sometime. I'll have you on when you have some time. You should come on my show and we'll do the same thing.
For sure.
But yeah, so I mean, if all of your listeners were to put, you know, $500 or $400 or even $300, whatever you can afford, if everybody were to put just a little bit of money into Bitcoin, it would take off. And it wouldn't matter how many mainstream media hit pieces come out saying that it's dangerous and it's unpatriotic and all this nonsense. It just wouldn't matter, because if people use it, then it takes off and you would just cripple the traditional banking system and allow people to have control over their own finances, where, you know, when you store money in Bitcoin, it can't be stolen from you in the form of inflation, can't be done in a bank seizure like in Cyprus. It's just your money at that point and you can use it however the hell you want with, you know, very minimal fees when you do so. And yeah, so if people want to check me out, I'm at davidseaman.net, and the book is on Amazon Kindle Store. It's called Total Abundance, Total Power. It's about how technology and communication is changing the world.
Nice. Yeah, that's, you know, not to go off on a whole other thing, but that's a big part of the giant conspiracy, is that the possibility for abundance is there in a lot of ways in different sectors, energy being one, and that it is being suppressed. And that there's a battle between the technology and the structure we have, because people are getting replaced by machines, and now those people don't have jobs, and that means those people can't even live in our society. So that title alone, Total Abundance, Total Power, I think is, you know, pretty important. I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, it's like your alien example. If aliens came to this planet, I think they would be kind of surprised by the whole idea of money, because once we get to a point where energy is abundant and where communications technology is used by everybody, like by 2020, I think 3 billion additional people have access to the internet. Once you have those kinds of things, we're only talking about a generation or two between us and kind of like a real Star Trek future, you know?
As it is now, we got homeless people begging for change outside of a grocery store stocked with groceries while they're throwing away expired stuff in a locked dumpster out back. That doesn't make any sense. But either way, you know, thanks again, man. We'll stay in touch, and best of luck fighting the good fight. It's been awesome. And tell the people your website is.
Yeah, my website's davidseaman.net.
Perfect. Easy to remember. All right, man. Well, hey, enjoy your day. Thanks for coming on the show.
All right. You too. Thank you.
All righty. There we have it, Higher Side Chatters. David Seaman of the David Seaman Hour. Check him out. He's a good man, Charlie Brown. Thanks again, all you folks that are sticking with me and my stupid Sonar show. Again, I'd love to see some of you out there at Conspiracy Con, June 1st and 2nd, out in the San Francisco-ish area. Some of you have already emailed me that you're going to be there. Super excited. I might need someone to help me film some stuff, so let me know about that too. Please share the show wherever you can. Review THC on iTunes. Donate if you get that special feeling. Or buy yourself a t-shirt at conspiracies.net. I appreciate everything that each and every one of you do to help me get this show going and growing. We have so many listeners now that I actually get a bit nervous when I think about how many people are tuning in. So this is a good thing. But one example, out of the 15,000 shows on Stitcher Smart Radio, THC is now in the top 400. And that's only about 20% of our listeners tuning in on Stitcher as their platform. So, yeah, shit. But anyway, enough of that. I'm getting myself hard already. Next week, we'll be talking to Foster Gamble of the Procter & Gamble family, the creator of the movie Thrive, which I recommend all of you check out. It'll be a good precursor to the interview. You'll know what we're talking about. He's also one of the main speakers at Conspiracy Con, conveniently. It's all connected, people. Thanks again, and may the Bitcoins never steer you wrong. Peace. I swear, the world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire. Yeah, I would have a show like Oprah. I would be the host of everyday Christmas. Give Travi a wish list. I'd probably pull a Angelina and Brad Pitt and adopt a bunch of babies that ain't never had shit. Give away a few Mercedes like, here, yeah, lady, have this. And last but not least, grant somebody their last wish. It's been a couple months that I've been single, so you can call me Travi Claus, minus the ho-ho. Get it? I'd probably visit where Katrina hit. And damn sure do a lot more than FEMA did. Yeah, can't forget about me, stupid. Everywhere I go, I'ma have my own theme music. Oh, every time I close my eyes, what you see, bro? I see my name in shining lights. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, yeah. Then what else? A different city every night. Oh, yeah. I swear, the world better prepare for, what? For when I'm a billionaire. With the president, dunking on his delegates, then I compliment him on his political etiquette. Toss a couple million in the air just for the heck of it, but keep the 520 tins and bins completely separate. Yeah, I'd be in a whole new tax bracket. We in recession, but let me take a crack at it. I'd probably take whatever's left and just split it up, so everybody that I love can have a couple bucks. And not a single tummy around me would know what hungry was, eating good, sleeping soundly. I know we all have a similar dream. Go in your pocket, pull out your wallet, put it in the air and sing. I wanna be a billionaire so fucking bad. So bad. Buy all of the things I never had.
Buy everything.
I wanna be on the cover of Forbes magazine, smiling next to Oprah and the Queen.
What up, Oprah?
Oh, every time I close my eyes,
what you see, bro?
I see my name in shining lights.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what else?
A different city every night.
Yeah.
I swear, the world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire. Be a billionaire, uh-huh. So fucking bad.